Hello and welcome to Hack the Deal, where we sit down with the world's leading experts in emerging tech to uncover the latest trends, why they're important, and how you can get involved. I'm your host, Matt Brown. My very special guest on this episode of Hack the Deal is my good friend Pauline Coble, who's doing some incredible work empowering youth and women across Africa. Pauline is a leading innovation expert in developing and emerging economies, an impact investor, and seasoned impact-driven team leader with over 20 years' experience in international affairs and venture philanthropy. Pauline is founder and CEO of Afri Prospect and founder and managing partner at SheEquity, which we'll talk more about a little later. In this episode, we talk about Pauline's journey, including her escape from the Rwandan Civil War, her path to the U.S., where she was awarded with a double Fulbright Fellow, her work at the UN, and ultimately the work she's doing today to close the gender funding gap across Africa, including actionable advice on how we can all participate. Pauline, hello, and welcome to the show.
Hello, Matt. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, of course. I'm super excited to dig in here because you've got an incredible background, an incredible story, and in general are doing some really important work across the region. Why don't we start off by telling the listeners a little bit about your background and ultimately how you grew up and how you got into innovation and entrepreneurship.
So I was born and raised in Rwanda, one of the most beautiful countries, I would say. And so I grew up in a very loving family, caring family. As a kid, I never had to worry about what to eat, you know, or anything else. I had to worry about doing what I'm told to do. As any kid who grew up in Africa, you know, if you don't do what you're supposed to do, you know what happened. So, I don't know if you know that, Matt. Do you know what that means?
I think I had a similar upbringing.
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny, growing up then, I never thought this is abuse, you know. So you get punished if you don't do what you're supposed to do. So anyway, fast forward, I was in law school in my first year of law school when the 1994 event happened, the Civil War that led to many people leaving the country and also many other people losing their lives. Yep. So this was something that no one can ever prepare for. And again, you're going from being a happy kid where you just have to worry about going to school, getting your grades, to running for your life. And so I must say I'm one of the few lucky ones because I made it alive. I end up finding myself in DRC Congo. And then suddenly became a refugee, and I got to really understand what that meant when I was there. You basically become a number. And being a number means your name, your identity doesn't really matter. No one really cares. You're just one of the millions, and we were millions, because many people have left Rwanda in search of safety, hoping that things are going to, you know, calm down and we can all go back. And in essence, as a kid, you think you go back to having a normal life. But this never happened. One thing that also hits you when you are in a refugee camp where you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, you have no agenda, every day looks the same. You just lose a purpose. You have no sense of what you're supposed to be doing. So I was able to meet up with a few former friends, classmates from Rwanda, and we decided to go and volunteer because there were quite a lot of people dead on streets, kids abandoned, lying on the ground. So we said, okay, rather than just sitting there feeling sorry for ourselves, we can actually go and help, which then will occupy our mind so we're not feeling sorry for ourselves. And so that was actually a good move because, one, suddenly you had a purpose, you had something to do, and also you felt that helping out, on one hand, gave you a purpose during that tragic time, I would say, but also it was a way to learn what else can you do, because at the end, you didn't really know how long you're going to stay there. And lucky enough, a few months later, the first humanitarian organization that came to work to help out, they basically hired the first people they found who were volunteering. So I was among the first people who were hired to actually help out the refugees and then, you know, be a refugee helping other refugees. So my first job was with UNICEF in DRC Congo. So basically helping, you know, families find their kids, but also kids try to find the families. And fast forward, things didn't seem safe in Goma where we were. And we basically were advised to leave the area, or no one knew what was going to happen. So I tried to smuggle myself out of DRC Congo, and I proudly say smuggle myself today when I look back. That time was scary. A few times tried, wasn't successful, and then keep trying. Because that's one thing I learned as well, being in a refugee camp, you don't give up, you keep trying. Try once, you fail, then you learn something, you try again. At some point you make it. So I made it at some point to actually Kenya, and then fast forward, I was in Senegal, and later on I was able to immigrate to the US as a documented refugee. And then basically had to start from zero, meaning really zero, because when I arrived in the US, I didn't know anyone. My English was not there. So I was welcomed by families that I didn't know that were very, very kind. Took me in, helped me remind myself why I wanted to go to the US. And really why I wanted to go to US was I wanted to go back to school. And so when I arrived, I was told, okay, you need to find a job, pay your bills. I said, fine, I can do that. But how do I go back to school? So I got the first job, did it. And the families that were helping me basically guided me in terms of how do you go back to. I registered for university, which I did. And sure enough, once I was back to school, I decided to make sure that I do very well. At the end, I graduated with straight A's, and I got a lot of scholarships, and one of them being basically the Fulbright that sent me to Europe, to the UN, and the rest of the history. When I look back, I was supported by so many people, to the point that at the end, when I, you know, arrived at the point where I could choose again what to do with my life, I chose to focus on a purpose-driven career. And this has basically led me also to setting up She Equity.
What an incredible story. Thank you for sharing that with us. If I could ask a couple of questions. How old were you when you had to run from Rwanda?
I was actually a bit grown up. I was 22.
You were 22.
Yeah. Right.
So you were in law school, you said.
Yeah, I was in my first year of law school.
And then you also talked about failing to smuggle yourself out of the DRC Congo. What is failing to smuggle yourself out? What does that mean?
So basically, you pay people to smuggle somewhere, and then you get caught, and then you brought back to where you started. And in some cases, you get punished, so and you are watched, so you can't leave again. So which means you have to find a different strategy if you want to try again.
Yeah.
And so you try different options that at the end you have an objective, which is to basically get out. To put things in perspective, it wasn't that I wanted to go somewhere because I wanted to go somewhere, right? It was just like this was the option I had if I wanted to survive, to have a future. And then when I watch today all the things around refugees, immigrants, in essence reminds me of what I went through at that time.
And so you were 22 when you left Rwanda. How old were you when you made your way to the US?
I think I was 27.
Okay, so
27, 28.
You spent 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. 28, yeah.
All right, you spent 6 years essentially on the run, you know, as a refugee from war, working to help, you know, make the lives of other refugees as tolerable as possible. You have the opportunity to escape. You go to the US. How did you end up migrating to the US from Africa? How did that work?
When I went to Senegal, I actually went with my sister because her husband was working there. I end up, you know, finding a job and really feeling like this was a good place to be, and also feeling like I could restart my life. But I wasn't making enough money to go back to school. You remember when I had to go to school somehow? And then I was still a refugee, which means I didn't really have a country that could protect me. So I had no belonging. The way it worked, every year the U.S. government then would decide on which countries that they add on a priority list for immigration, legal immigration to the country. So I'm talking about legal, right?
Yes.
So they have a system in the countries that will basically process the documentation. You get an interview, you answer all the questions. And then an organization in Tucson, Arizona had chosen me as a person that they were willing to support. And it was interesting later on when I arrived and then we became friends with my caseworker. They told me that time this organization was interested in starting to you know, accept African refugees, but they were not ready to just take many cases. So they wanted to have one case and try it and see if it works out. Then they can decide whether they're going to bring more, accept more, you know. So I was, in essence, like a case study.
Wow.
An ambassador for other refugees, but I didn't know then, right? But it seems because I spoke some English, not really enough, but also I think I was smart enough. So I learned very, very quickly. And it was easy, I guess, for them because I was young, driven, ambitious, really doing everything they wanted me to do because I had my eyes on one goal, which was to go to school. So I would do whatever they wanted as long as I can go to school. So then they were super happy with having me. And then they decided to bring on many other refugees. But I was among the first African refugees that arrived in Tucson, Arizona.
No pressure, right?
No pressure. But the thing is, was again, you put things in perspective. So I was coming from far away. I had hit the rock bottom before. So whatever else pressure for me, that was a picnic. There was no, I didn't even feel any pressure because I had an apartment, I had everything I needed.
What an incredible roller coaster from everything's fine and great in law school one minute to a refugee of war on the run, more or less for 6 years, end up as the trial case for refugees in Tucson, Arizona. You then end up at the University of Arizona, correct?
Yeah, that's where I went to school, yes.
So the University of Arizona, and then afterwards you ended up in the UK. Tell us how you made the jump from the US to the UK.
So basically when I finished my undergrad, I had really done very well. So I had the grades to basically allow me to get scholarship in the places. And so my professor advised me to apply for Fulbright scholarship. I was like, there's no way I can get this one because I just became a US citizen then. So you had to be a US citizen to apply. And then the one thing about Fulbright scholarship, you're supposed to go to a country, become almost like an ambassador of your country to this other country. So now I'm just a new American, as they called us.
Mm.
I was supposed to pretend I can actually go and represent the US in the UK, which for me was quite intimidating. And then the second, I looked at who has applied, who didn't get in. And so because this is the one country where one language you need to know to be admitted is English, because in other countries you have to know the other languages. So pretty much many Americans who didn't want to learn other languages were applying to go to UK. So it was highly competitive. But again, my mentors at university convinced me that I stand a chance. They actually really supported me through the application process. And sure enough, I got it. And that's how I came to UK. So I was admitted to IDS, which is number one, actually, School for International Development in the world almost every year. It's a private institute. I was not going to afford it. Again, remembering where I came from, I was fully, you know, paid. By the way, I'm proud to say I got my degrees all the way without having any loan.
That's incredible.
School. Yeah. So basically, again, a lot of people ready to support my dream, which was to go all the way, study, and be able to use my studies to contribute to society.
Very cool. I just quickly looked up Fulbright Award winners. There's been 88 Fulbright winners who have won the Pulitzer Prize, 60 have won the Nobel Prize, 38 have served as heads of state or government, 10 have been elected to the U.S. Congress, one Secretary General of the United Nations. It's quite a distinguished list that you're a part of. So I congratulate you on the good fortune, but also the work that went into that, because it's quite a feat. So you make your way to the UK. I believe you went to work for UNESCO. You ultimately ended up at the African Innovation Foundation. How did you make the pivot from nonprofit to entrepreneurship? Or more importantly, why did you see entrepreneurship as a way to build community and build ecosystems as opposed to aid and or nonprofit service?
So beyond all the things you just mentioned, I think what this kind of scholarship push you to do is reflect on why do you want to get this scholarship? What are you going to do with it? And you write it in a way that you actually also have to be convinced yourself to convince others. So I remember when I was at WHO in Geneva, really enjoying my job at UN. And as you said, I had also worked for UNESCO. By the way, as a Fulbright Fellow, I went back and looked at my files and I was reading about what I have written. And I realized I had achieved one thing, which was really to build a good network and also to understand how international systems work, what are the opportunities, what are the challenges. But I didn't feel like I can share with anyone a personal story of how I was contributing to making a world a better place. I was a part of a bigger system, which assumably would allow me to do a lot, but what you realize once you are in, you are too small sometimes to feel like you're making an impact. I always remember again how I got there. That's my thing. Whenever I start thinking or questioning, I go back. And I realize where I was, I had many opportunity, many options. I could stay there and wait until I feel like I'm able to contribute, or could just look for other opportunities and explore where I can have a direct impact. So that's basically how I ended up leaving. And then I was recruited to join African Innovation Foundation with a focus for catalyzing innovation across Africa. And so, to be honest with you, that time I didn't really know much about innovation entrepreneurship, but I was curious to see if there's another way that you can actually really contribute in a meaningful way. And again, because I had options, I could try it. If it doesn't work, I could leave and try something else. So I tried it, and sure enough, this has been for me the most learning experience. As an African who grew up in Africa, I have never taken time to reflect on innovation and entrepreneurship in the context of Africa. I have never been taught about this. Like, for me, at least at that time, innovation entrepreneurship was almost associated with quote-unquote developed countries, but not developing countries, emerging market. So at the job, I had to learn about how the Asian country have made it, like realizing how no country has ever developed without investing in innovation entrepreneurship and homegrown innovation and entrepreneurship. And I was equipped with the tools and money to basically go and find the best innovators and then give them a platform, one, to get funded, but also to tell their story so they can inspire other young Africans, but also the global audience to realize that Africa actually has the capacity to innovate, to solve challenges on the continent, but also the capacity to help solve the global challenges. So it has been quite exciting to learn on the job and then become a champion and a catalyst for innovation and have a chance really to work with innovation enablers and other catalysts across the continent. Because my job involved basically working with all countries from Cairo to Cape Town, talking innovation, finding the best innovators and also connecting them with the right partners and the right investors so they can grow and scale their businesses.
Very cool. And we'll touch on some of the things that you're doing now to help scale innovation across the continent. But before we do, I've heard you often say entrepreneurship and innovation, not aid. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think a lot of has been said on this, and also books have been, you know, written. The point, again, as I just said a few minutes ago, no country has ever developed without investing in homegrown innovation entrepreneurship. So when you look at the billion being spent in Africa or other emerging markets in terms of aid or in the name of development, so one has to ponder and ask, what do you have to show for this much money? So it seems like at least about 50 billion minimum is spent a year in Africa in terms of aid and name of international development. And also the different research show how this amount is actually written down as an aid going to African countries or other countries. The higher percentage of the money stays back in the countries that are quote unquote providing the aid.
It often comes with strings attached and they're optimizing for the wrong variables. And I can see how that would cause a conflict. You've spent an awful lot of your time and efforts over the past decade plus focusing on empowering particularly the youth and women across the continent. Right now, Africa's having a moment where I think the entrepreneurship spirit has been unleashed to the capital markets, whereby I think $4 billion has been raised by new entrepreneurs this year. But we still see less than 1% of that going to women founders. What are some of the structural challenges that you see, particularly around youth and women across the continent?
I think one is existing bias when it comes to women. There's quite different systematic bias, whether it's around who gets funded, who gets access to capital based on the fact that most of the women don't have access to collateral. But also there's a link with the fact that you don't have a lot, actually you don't have many women capital allocators who are in the position also to make decisions. Because at the end, when you look at the landscape of investment in Africa, the majority of investors don't necessarily look like the people they're trying to invest in. And this leads to what people have labeled like affinity bias. It goes with the language, the questions that female founders are being asked versus the questions that are asked to the men. And unless we change the picture where you have also more women who are actually in a position to make investment decision, which means then they're not going to be applying the same bias that we're tending to see that are leading to this really alarming statistic, not much will change. And the other issues around the existing ecosystems that are not really in a position to provide the kind of support that needed to actually address those structural challenges. You know, knowing that if you are operating in a different African ecosystem and you are a woman running early stage businesses, the kind of challenges you face might make it harder for you to seem like you are an investor ready, which means at some point you might not even get an interview to pitch to investors. So one, you might not be able to get in the door to share your story. The second, once you get into the door, you're pitching to people who might have some biases, whether they are conscious or unconscious, that lead them to prefer to invest in the male counterpart instead of you because of the assumptions they have. We are working on this. That's why initiatives such as She Equity exists. Because we realize one can sit down and worry and be kind of disappointed by those statistics, or you can put system in a place that one are addressing some of those risks and also those structural challenges. And second, you put in a place teams that we'll be screening the investment deals without having those biases, whether they're conscious or unconscious.
What's startling to me is the research is very, very clear on this topic. Investing in women founders in technology yields a 35% better return on investment than investing in men. You would think that institutional investors would incorporate this public data as part of their mandate when they're deploying capital. Why aren't we seeing that data translate into results?
It's all about perceived risk, because one, Africa, for many who haven't spent, you know, enough time on African continent, it seems to be a risk continent to do business with, which again, this is really, you know, tied to perceived risk, because investors like you, other people who actually spend time on the continent, one, they get to realize that you're talking about 54 countries or 55, depending on what you use, right? So yeah. To think that the whole continent is risky, how is it possible, right? So that's number one. The second is, if your target is not Africa and you don't have a team on the ground, perhaps you have other options. You can invest in Europe, in the US. You ask yourself, why should I go to a continent that I don't know much about, that also media and everyone seem to tell me that it's too risky, right? But the good news is those investors who are coming on the continent and taking time wanted to work with the local teams and then managed to distinguish the perceived risk and real risk and devise strategy to actually have a risk mitigation, they're realizing this is the best place to be, because Africa is not just the next frontier, it is different. It is happening right now. Again, you mentioned $4 billion raised this time. So the investor who are coming in and making those investment decisions and seeing the upside, they, in essence, paving the way where other people will come in, because at the end of the day, you need leaders in the markets and then other people will follow.
I couldn't agree more. And to that point, the reason I got interested in Africa was because it reminded me a lot of Latin America, which is a region that I know well. And what happened in 2016 is you had big institutional investors start making bets in the region, and that unleashed a flood of capital to the region that is resulting in what we're seeing today, which it's essentially a unicorn factory right now in LATAM. I suspect we're going to see the same in Africa. We're just starting to get past the first wave, where some founders are starting to have some mega success and then recycle some of that capital and some of that knowledge back into the startup ecosystem. Yeah. But we're still not seeing it go to the right people in the ecosystem. We're still not seeing it reach women founders in particular. It seems to me like there's a huge arbitrage opportunity here. If we know that women are better stewards of capital, we know they generate higher ROI, what can we do as investors to arbitrage this?
So as investors, we need to be putting our money where our mouth, you know, are, because I think there's quite a lot of talk about the gender funding gap that we all discuss in different forums. So we need to pause and ask ourselves, how long can we discuss this issue as if we can't solve it? And the second, we need to be working together and also investing in existing structure that have set up a system to actually address this. And at the end of the day, we all want to generate like profit for our investors, but also have an impact. And one thing that is clear, investing in a woman-led business is give you both more than any other area you can invest. And also today, when everyone is concerned about climate change or other issues, there's quite a lot of research showing how if you invest in a woman, not only you're gonna have a financial return, but you're also going to have a social and environmental return. So one concrete example of how we support investors who want to achieve the triple bottom line is we have set up a structure where we have a technical assistance facility called SHIBA, Share Equity Business Accelerator, which basically allow us to identify promising businesses that might not be ready for investment and work with them for about 16 weeks, in essence, around de-risking and structuring and getting them investment ready before we can actually consider them for investment. So we are very intentional focusing on women. One of the challenges that you hear many investors citing is that they can't find a deal. You know, they say, okay, fine, I'm interested in investing in women in Africa, but where are they? One other statistic that gets repeated over and over is that there's 40% of SMEs in Africa that are run by women. But then investors say they can't find them. And one of the reasons those businesses, you can't find them, is because many investors are looking for perfect deals. If you're coming from Silicon Valley, your view of a perfect deal is the same, you know, deal you have seen in Silicon Valley, even though the environment, the ecosystem is not the same. So working with structure like Shiba, where we know that there's many businesses that exist there, but those businesses might not be appealing to investors who are ready to write check, and working towards getting them ready, that's number one. So broadening the pipeline. And the second is being able to build that pipeline where one can write early stage ticket to actually get more people moving towards a higher ticket, because the early stage investment segment is also where I'm seeing many investors are going in. Why? Because the risks are higher, but the reward is also higher. But only those investors who are in the market, who understand the culture and all other things on the ecosystem, can take the risk to go there, because they would have a risk mitigation strategy to basically make sure that when they write check, they're also providing the technical assistance facility or other options to get the money invested to go directed to building a business instead of addressing other things that many local founders struggle with, that if we ignore them, then it's no good for the business either.
Yeah, it seems to me like at a minimum, right, there's a number of ways that you can mitigate risk. Position sizing is one of them. Right? So let's say investing in women-led companies is more risky, which the research would contradict that. Yeah. But let's say that it is more risky. Then a couple of prudent strategies you could deploy is, number one, become an advisor to the company.
Right? Yeah.
And put in some sweat equity and help build that sustainable knowledge base to make them successful. The second would simply be position sizing. By controlling the amount of capital that are going into those bets, you could still capture some of the increased upside while managing your downside risk. And so these are known strategies within the startup ecosystem that people deploy. The interesting point that you made around people are looking for Silicon Valley-like deals or deals that they've looked for before. I was guilty of that too when I came to the region. You go with what you know in the playbook until you understand the contextual framework by which businesses are operating on the continent. Once you understand that, you understand that while the game is generally the same, the rules are slightly different. And by looking for deals that look like Silicon Valley deals or even Latin American deals on the continent, you're actually increasing your selection bias. Because what you're going to end up doing is backing a lot of non-African founders.
That's happening.
On the continent, right? Who are exploiting those similarities to access pools of capital that are a lot easier to raise. And not to say anything bad about them, I think there's plenty of non-African founders doing fantastic work across the continent. But there's not enough capital going to African founders, particularly African women founders. So for those of us who would like to do more and would like to get more involved in backing women-led founders or allocating a percentage of our portfolio, how would you advise us to get smarter about the topic and actually start putting our money where our mouths are?
So there are different options to consider. One is if you have the time and you can spend it in understanding the market, go on the ground and get a feel of what are really risk versus perceived risk, because at the distance, you're getting information that has been filtered for different reasons. Of course, today, you go from Nigeria to Kigali, to Nairobi, to Johannesburg, to Cairo. So you will just quickly realize that you cannot be talking about Africa as one market.
Yep.
You will confirm that you need to have a strategy for each market and also look at the opportunity in each market, which means it becomes easier for you also to devise mitigation strategy. Because if you're thinking, okay, I want to invest in Africa, I don't know where to go. Wow, where do I begin? Too much risk. You're never going to begin. So that's if you are ambitious enough and you have a time and you want to go and test it yourself. And then once on the ground, you will meet different founders, get to know them. Because at end, when you invest, also you have to build trust with the companies you're investing in. So being on the ground, getting to know them, it helps you. If you can't do that, then I would suggest you work with the likes of ShareEquity, other funds that are on the ground, that have local team, that understand the cultures, basically that can help you address some of the questions you might have, invest your money, but also that are willing or possible to give you opportunity if you want to get involved as a mentor, as an advisor to the team. So that could be like a transition where you go through existing structure to basically invest. The advantage of this, it means if you have more capital, you can actually invest in more companies, because it means you don't have to go around finding them yourselves. And again, at the end, trust is important and understanding the ecosystem, the culture is important. So going with existing structure will give you probably a lot of options. And the other option is joining syndicates. I think that's what you're doing in Matt. You do it very, very well. So when you join syndicates, so you basically one sharing, putting capital together, assessing risk together, but also on the top of that, especially if your intention is to invest in early stage startup, you work together to support the company that you invest in. Because when you invest at early stage, the cash alone is not enough. I can never emphasize this. Cash alone is not enough. You need to put cash on the table, but you need to be ready to also roll your sleeve and support the founder on different aspects of the business, including strategy, including organization, governance, because again, most of them might be the first time they're finding a company. They understand the business, they understand the market, but they might need someone to advise on other aspects of the business that you have the capability to do. And the other angle is really to open your network, you know. So I got to meet you, Matt, because I was speaking to a friend, Tommy Davis, right?
That's right.
So you and I, we have a network that connects us to other networks. Most of the founders that you're investing in, they might not have the same network as yours. Whether you go through the existing structure, you join a syndicate, or you get on the ground and identify who to work with, those will allow you to actually make it the right investment decisions.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I've given this a lot of thought because I'm also thinking in the context of my own personal portfolio. How do I fund more female entrepreneurs? And it's a hard question. The syndicate model doesn't really work well, because what I've learned in building a syndicate, and we have one with Prodigio Capital, is that most of the LPs within a syndicate are looking for lookalike deals, right? They're looking for those Silicon Valley lookalike deals. Give me the tier one VC that is co-investing. Give me the unicorn founder that is co-investing. And it permeates this selection bias that you're talking about. I genuinely believe the right way to go about this is dedicated funds that are then accessible to people like me and our LPs at Prodigio Capital, who want to allocate a percentage of their net worth to not only the asset class of startup tech, but in particular, the arbitrage opportunity of investing in women-led founders for outsized returns. And the challenge with that, of course, is funds typically have a high minimum. They're typically larger check sizes. So one of the things that we've been playing with at Prodigio is how do we set up an SPV fee-free, no fees, no carry, that would allow people to contribute at a check size that is comfortable, that makes sense for their risk appetite, to a vehicle that could then allocate directly to SHE Equity or other funds with a specified mandate. And it would be a special purpose vehicle solely focused on funding women entrepreneurs and capitalizing on that opportunity. We're still playing around with it. I would love to get the feedback from the people in the audience. I'm more than happy to carry the administration cost of doing this. I think it's a worthwhile mission. I will contribute my own capital to it as I look to round out my own portfolio. But as you're listening to this, please reach out if you would like to get involved on that level. If people want to learn more about SHE Equity and the work you're doing, particularly around innovation and entrepreneurship across the continent, what's the best way for them to do that?
The best way to learn about SHE Equity is to reach out to me, my email address. I'm assuming you can put it somewhere in notes, Matt.
It'll be in the show notes, yes.
It's p.kolber@sheequity.com. And also our website, www.sheequity.com. We are also on LinkedIn and as a SHE Equity on a Twitter and a Facebook. And I would love to talk to you. And I think what you're planning to do sounds amazing. I think a very well-structured and targeted syndicate works better than the typical ones where you let people decide or reinforce existing bias. And so for us, the reason I set up SHE Equity Ready was exactly that. Initially, I had the same choice to join a syndicate, but I realized depending on who you're able to influence to come on board is not scalable. And I realized if we wanted to close the existing gender funding gap, which right now in Africa is $42 billion US dollars, it was important to have a fund that is fully dedicated, really investing in early stage company. And we believe that the combination of our strategy that involves SHIBA, which basically it's a TA facility, and the SHE Equity Fund allows us to minimize the risk before we can actually write checks and build a trusted pipeline that every investor wants to have. Because at the end of the day, I know, Matt, you were saying it's hard to find female founders. I don't think it's hard to find them. It's hard to find the investment ready, fitting our perception of what's investment ready as we know it.
That's right.
Our intention is actually to build an ecosystem where we get more women founder into the pipeline, get them fit for investment, and then invest in them, then that's not a problem. When we launched our first cohort of SHIBA this year, we got 2,000 applications from 40 countries in a month.
Wow.
Of course, not all of them were, qualified, but again, that shows you how many women founders who are out there getting ready to be funded. So if you have an ecosystem that is working towards onboarding those 2,000 into some kind of support, and again, I understand this is not a business of investors. As investors, we want to find the perfect deal and invest in them. But I'm also sharing this because at the end of the day, there is a need to build an ecosystem that actually address existing structural challenges and biases that female founders face. And I think there's an opportunity for blended finance where public and private investors work together to build an ecosystem where we de-risk or minimize the risk pool of potential deals that we can all invest in. And so if we all wait to find the perfect deals, I'm afraid we're going to have to wait for long and we're going to continue to complain about not finding deals. But like everywhere in the world, there is always a tools and a way to move from A to Z. So we can apply that. And that's what exactly we're doing at SHE Equity.
To me, it's clear. The data is clear that there's a fantastic arbitrage opportunity here to recognize outsized returns. The easiest way to capture that is to ensure that you don't let selection bias creep into your capital allocation. The easiest way to do that is to outsource your selection to people who are experts in this field and perhaps don't have that selection bias. So it's clear to me that every investor in early stage tech should have a percentage of their portfolio allocated to female founders. And they're going to increase their returns by doing so. Is there any parting thoughts that you would like to leave with our listeners?
I just wanted to highlight the fact that we all will benefit by closing the existing gender funding gap. And in terms of those who are still worried about the risk, we are ready to work with you. Reach out to us so we can actually be able to support you, build a portfolio that you want to have, where you can achieve your financial return and also higher impact. And as we all know, Africa is the place to be. 1.3 billion people, the youthful continent, all opportunities are in Africa. So the sooner as an investor you look into opportunity in Africa, the better for you. So anyone wanting to make money, have an impact, Africa is the place to invest. And investing in women is even the best way to actually achieve the impact and profit at the same time.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, Pauline, thank you again. Her fund is SheEquity, SHEQUITY.com. I encourage everyone that is listening and found this interesting and insightful to go check it out. And until next time. This episode of Hack the Deal is brought to you by Prodigio Capital. Prodigio runs a syndicate allowing you to invest in the best founders across Latin America and Africa. For as little as $1,000, you can get started building your own diversified portfolio of tech startups in the most attractive regions in the world. There's no upfront fees or commitments, and you get the flexibility to choose which deals you'd like to participate in, retaining total control over your portfolio. To learn more, check out our website at prodigiocapital.com. That's P-R-O-D-I-G-I-O capital.com.